Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's easy to see from this discussion that the CSCE was a huge success. And I say that because, as we all know, success has a thousand fathers. And we've found several fathers already in this discussion. I hate to add the United States to that list because we're so well known as opponents of everything good about the CSCE, but nonetheless, I think Ambassador Ferraris provided a good insight into why it is that perceptions about the United States' role are so distorted. It is that very little is known about what the United States was doing in NATO consultations during the period 1969 through 1972. And I think for historians, that is the untold story, which I hope you will begin to look into. As a modest effort in that direction, I brought a paper, which some of you may have picked up. I don't think any of you have read it, judging by comments so far. But in it, I think there is a convincing story documented by State Department telegrams and other internal documents, which I acquired from the archives, about what was actually happening. I think the story really begins for historians in 1968, and it's in the modern incarnation of this old Soviet idea, because the Prague Spring and the Brezhnev Declaration, I think, did lead directly to the beginnings of the preparation for the CSCE. I think the assumption of leadership in three important countries also had a very important effect in 1969, President Nixon, of course, President Pompidou, and Chancellor Brandt, and each in their own way contributed to the beginning of the CSCE. I won't recount all of that. I will simply point out that in April of 1969, the State Department instructed the U.S. mission to NATO to launch studies about East-West negotiations, and that in December of 1969, the Department of State introduced a declaration on European relations, paragraph 11 of which referred to the freer movement of people, information, and ideas. That idea of the United States was pushed vigorously for the next 2 years over the opposition, I must say, of some Europeans. And I would mention in particular one episode in 1971 in which the German delegation on instructions came to tell us and all of us in NATO that they really didn't favor proceeding the way the United States was contemplating with regard to freer movement. They wanted instead to speak about cultural relations. And as the reports from U.S. NATO, which I described in this report, suggested, it was an effort to beat back that counteroffensive on human rights. I don't single out the Germans in particular, but they, of course, had a particular sensitivity about it because of the East German relationship that was evolving rapidly at that time. So I think you will find in this paper a record of what the United States was doing during this time. Jack Maresca says that there were not two U.S. policies, and I suppose in a way he's right. I actually do speak about two U.S. policies in this document, because if you read what's in this red book, which is mainly based on White House documents, you will see a policy that does not correspond at all to the policy that the Secretary of State at the time, whose name I've not heard mentioned yet, his name happened to be William P. Rogers, and is little known, not much written about, but in fact he persistently and constantly said that we should be not rejecting this idea of a conference, but should be trying to turn it to our own advantage, and that was his basic position. And armed with that position, the bureaucratic steamroller, of which I was one part, was able to make good use of it. The other untold story, I think, I haven't heard it yet today mentioned in any detail, is the fact that all of the work that was being done in NATO, and Jacques Andrian was there through a good part of it, led quite directly to the preparation of papers within the European community. And there was, surprisingly, a quite high degree of correspondence between the work that was being done at NATO and the papers that eventually came out of the EC consultations. I always considered that was a very, very fortuitous event, because in 1973, William B. Rogers was forced out of the State Department. Henry Kissinger took over. And at that point, the attitude which he had not been able to put across from his position as National Security Advisor was put into effect, and the State Department basically had to recede from the leading position that had been taken. The torch was picked up, happily, by the European community at that point, and the same positions which we had been talking about in NATO were then being advanced by the European community. So I consider that to be one of the lucky things of history that happened, which might not otherwise, had there not been this development of European political consultations, and which got underway in earnest in October of 1972. I recount in my paper a little bit of Jacques Andriani's biography, and I hope I'm correct on that, but when he went to take up this new post in October of 1972, I think he was able to take the lead in pushing through a lot of these ideas. British position I discuss a little bit, and I found that it fluctuated a little bit. There was clearly a quite cynical attitude about it, perhaps throughout, but towards the end, the British really began to take the lead in preparing positions within NATO. And one of the last things I talked about in this paper in 1972 was a steering brief. Perhaps you wrote it. Which was introduced into NATO, and it essentially was a way of telling all the NATO countries how to deal with the negotiations, and I thought it played some role. As usual, plans that one makes in advance are not necessarily carried out in practice, but the process is what is important. Eisenhower used to say, planning is everything, the plans themselves are nothing. And this process of working together in the alliance here, I think, is what did, in fact, make it a success. I don't think that one can come to a conclusion about motivations. Tom Blanton asked me where did this idea about the free movement come from? And I would have to say it probably came from some mid-level people in the Department of State who were drafting the declaration for NATO and wanted to include in it something that looked good. As usual, the motivations are mixed. The man who probably wrote it is a man named Leo Reddy, who had quite idealistic attitudes. He really did want to do something about ending the division of Europe. His boss was a man named Oliver Floyd, who had a quite opposite motivation. He was quite cynical about the whole thing. So what were the motivations? They were mixed. One never really knows. But the point is, there were two basic attitudes in Washington at the time. And I'll conclude with this. One was Henry Kissinger's, which is, look, the quicker we get through this, the better we all are, because it can't do us any possible good. In that respect, frankly, I think his views are more or less coincidental with the views of Moscow. Have a quick conference, get it behind us. And his calculation was it wouldn't amount to anything, and people would soon forget it. The other attitude was, look, we're going to have the conference, let's see if we can do something with it to get some concessions. And that was, of course, the bargaining position that the Department of State adopted. So I'll end with that. Now we'll come back to some of these other issues later. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Would be Ambassador Kushner to...
Thank you. A very brief remark, additional, about the role of